Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it's another regularly scheduled weekly episode where we are going to discuss one game. We're going to talk about how to play it. We're going to talk about how to win at it. And we're going to talk about how it was designed. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Magic Maze, designed by Casper Lopp and published in 2017 by Sit Down. And it was nominated for a whole bunch of stuff, including things like Spiel des Jahres, Trick Track d'Or, Golden Geek. So yeah, a pretty wide variety of stuff.
So for a short description on what Magic Maze is about, in Magic Maze, players work together to guide a party of mischievous adventurers as they find their way through a magical mall, steal some gear, and dash to the exits. Each player has a different cardinal direction that they can move the pawns in on the grid-based board, as well as different special powers that let the pawns use escalators, teleport through portals, or discover new rooms. There are two big catches with this game. First, the game is timed, and if the three-minute hourglass runs out, everyone loses. And second, players cannot talk at all during the game, except for the brief moments when they manage to flip the timer and get more time. If each adventurer can find their item, steal it, and make it out the exit in time, the players win. So that's a short description of the game. It is a game with no talking or communication between players, except for one very specific, very limited way of communicating, which we'll get to in a second. You have a tile-based map. You start with just one tile, and all the pawns start on it. And each tile has exits that the pawns have to move to find new tiles of the map, and those tiles will contain items that the pawns want to steal and exits that the pawns will exit through in order to steal them successfully. And the whole thing is timed.
Right.
All right. So I guess now that we're getting into the strategy portion, we should spend a little bit of time going over exactly what the players can do and what the pawns can do and how the game works a little more detailed.
Yeah.
All right. So where do we start?
Let's see. So let's start with each of the actions. Oh, yeah.
So this is an important part of the game, that the starting tile that the pawns start on has a compass on it that points to one of its edges, and that is considered north, in quotes. It's just north so that all the other compasses that show up in the game point in the same direction. And that's important because each player is dealt a card at the beginning of the game with an arrow on it. And after you point the compass on that card to match the same direction as the compass on the starting tile, then every player will have, at least in a four-player game, every player will have a different direction that their arrow points in. And that is the direction that that player can move the pawns in the game.
Right. They can move any pawn, but only they can move it in that direction, and they can only move it in that direction, unless they have one of the other extra abilities. We briefly touched on these a bit earlier.
So there are, so there's extra abilities that come on these cards. And those, there's only three of them. And they are escalators, portals, and discovering new tiles that are symbolized by an escalator, a portal, and a spyglass.
Right. Yeah. So the escalators will appear on specific tiles, and they always have two points that they connect between. And if a player can move along escalators, they can move a pawn from one side of the escalator to the other on that tile.
Yeah, it doesn't matter which direction the pawn is moving, like with regard to like arrow-wise, just whoever has the escalator ability can move a pawn along an escalator. And if you don't have that ability, then you cannot make a pawn use an escalator.
Right. Then there is the portals, which the main rule for the portals is that the player who has that portal ability can move a pawn from anywhere on the board to one of its associated colored portals. The four pawns are colored green, orange, purple, and yellow. So, like, the purple pawn, which is the wizard, can only go to the purple portals.
In the earlier levels of the game, and this game is played, like, there's multiple levels of difficulty that change the game as you play. But in early levels, the starting piece, the starting tile, has a portal for each pawn on it. And then the rest of the tiles, you'll have to discover more portals to to jump to other places if you have the portal ability.
Right. And then
the third ability is the most important one, because the third ability says that if a pawn is on the edge of a tile, on the exit of a tile, or not really the exit because there's an actual exit.
The edge.
But if the pawn is on the edge of a tile and its color matches the doorway on that tile, I guess is the best way of putting it.
Yeah.
Then the person with the explore ability can draw a new tile from the stack and attach it to that tile.
Right, yeah. And when you attach a tile this way, you just have to, there's like one of the edges on the new tile will have an arrow pointing inward, and that mm-hmm. edge has to be the one touching the doorway you opened.
Yes. So only that player can place new tiles, and these doorways have colors that match the pawns, so only a yellow pawn can peer through a yellow doorway to explore the next tile.
Yes. And now, so the reason you're exploring tiles is that you have to get your items and make a mad dash to the exit.
Right.
And these are two... Oh, did you want to mention something before we go into that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, yeah. Well, these are two specific types of objects that are on tiles. There's one for each color in each of these types. There are the stores, which... like I said, are associated with each color. They also have a symbol. So, like, the green one is the archer, who has a green store with a bow and arrow on it. Or the orange one is the dwarf barbarian, who has an axe on the store. Anyway, so that's, like, one specific tile on one tile. One space on one tile. And then another tile is going to have the exit, which has, like, the symbol of a person going through a door, like an exit sign. But each of those are also color coordinated.
Mm-hmm. And those will also butt up against the edge of the tile.
Yeah.
So we mentioned levels earlier. Just to expand on that a little more, the way that this game works is there's... how many levels are there, by the way? Are there 30?
Oh, I don't remember.
I think it's either like 20 or 30 levels to the game, somewhere
it's
around
there. It's not too many.
It's, I mean, it's kind of a lot. I mean, you have to play the game like 20 or 30 times to go through all of the content that they have in
but
it.
Like
but what we found out is that how many, is it 10 sessions, then you have everything unlocked?
I think it's 10 or 12.
10 to 12 sessions to have all of the mechanics unlocked.
Right. But first half of the game is like a tutorial.
Right. So at the first level, the very first level, you have all of the shops for each pawn shuffled into the stack of tiles, and you only have one exit, and it's technically the purple exit, but that doesn't matter because all of the pawns use the same exit in the first level. So that's where you start, is with the four shops, one exit, and then some extra tiles thrown in to just pad out the deck of tiles. And then every session thereafter, up until session 10 to 12, somewhere around there, you are adding a new mechanic every time you play. So the second time you play, you add the exits for the other pawns. And now each pawn has to exit through the same matching color exit. And then it continues on from there. Some of the mechanics that get added, let's see, they add a mechanic where every time you flip the timer, everyone has to rotate their arrow cards to the next player. So your role in the game is constantly changing.
Yeah.
They add...
I was going to say, each pawn has its own special ability.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the dwarf can go through small holes in walls. The wizard has a crystal ball that appears on one tile that allows the person who can discover new tiles discover two tiles and place them wherever. They eventually add security cameras, which prevent you from doing the last major mechanic we haven't really described, which is flipping the timer.
Mm-hmm.
But you can disable the security cameras with the yellow pawn.
And then the green pawn says that if it discovers a room, then you get to talk briefly before, after you discover the room, but before you move another piece. You get a brief moment to talk.
Yes.
So, let's talk about flipping the timer.
Yeah. So normally you can't talk while the game is going, but there are these red timer shaped spaces, like hourglass shapes, on certain tiles. And when a pawn moves onto this, you put a used token that just shows that you can't use that space anymore. And then you flip the timer upside down.
Mm-hmm. It's an hourglass timer.
Right.
So it starts full and it's got 3 minutes on it. And as it's draining, you're taking your actions. And then when you hit the timer button, you flip the timer over. And so it starts draining the other way. And before you move another piece, after you flip the timer, you get as much time as you want to talk strategy for the game.
Right. But as soon as you move a piece, you can't talk anymore mm-hmm. until the next timer is flipped.
Right. So I think that's pretty much every mechanic in the game. The rest is just figuring out how to coordinate with your allies. And then after all of the mechanics get introduced, then the game starts adding stipulations to the levels. Oh, there's one more mechanic that we absolutely need to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the gavel.
Yeah.
So we say that you cannot talk, but that doesn't mean that you cannot communicate. But there's a very specific way that the game forces you to communicate with other players, and you can't communicate any other way beyond that. And that is with a gavel. So the game comes with this large red wooden piece that is the gavel. And in order to indicate to somebody that they need to do something, you can place the gavel in front of them. And that is the only way you can communicate. You cannot do anything to indicate exactly what they need to do. You can't bang the gavel on the pawn you want them to move, or you can't bang the gavel near the board to show them where you want to move a thing. You can't gavel their abilities on their card to show like whether they need to move a piece in the arrow direction they have or use the other ability they have. You cannot gavel near the timer to show everybody that time is almost up.
Yeah,
and I have this long list of things that you should not do because we accidentally did them.
For the most part, it was you that did them.
Well, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
It's also important. You can't like bang the gavel furiously. The only thing you can do is place it in front of somebody.
Right. Yeah.
And that is the only specific. That is the only way that you can communicate anything to anybody during the silent portions of the game. When you are flipping the timer or when the green piece is discovering a room in later levels of the game, then you can just talk freely and gesture and do anything you want to communicate. But as soon as you start moving the pawns, it is quiet time and you can only use the gavel.
Right.
So then the rest of the game. Oh, there's a slight little extra thing to note about the portals is that after each pawn has stolen its thing. And by the way, this should also be mentioned. Each pawn has to be standing on the shop with the item that it needs to collect at the same time in order to trigger the second part of the game where they go for the exits. It's not like a pawn can go pick up its thing and exit before the other pawns have picked up their thing. So every pawn has to be standing at the same time on their shop spaces, and then they can go to the exits one by one. But after the pawns have picked up their items and stolen them, then the game goes to this mode where you're trying to leave the map, and also you cannot use portals at that time. The portals become locked off during the
escape. Fleeing.
Escape, yes.
Yeah.
All right, so those are all the mechanics in the game. So now we can talk strategy.
Okay. So, the thing that I think has helped us the most is planning in order when you're able to talk. So this is like, for example, when all the pawns are in position on their shops and you stop the timer to like plan ahead before you start moving again to the exits, you say like, we're going to do this pawn, then this pawn, then this pawn. And what that does is it just means everybody's kind of on the same page focusing on one thing. It can be kind of easy to get lost in this game in terms of figuring out where you have to do something. So if everybody just focuses on one pawn, the speed it takes and the efficiency it takes to do it one at a time outweighs the hectic scramble of trying to do everything at once.
Yeah.
So, which is sort of the general rule of thumb.
And that could work for both the opening portion of the game and the ending portion of the game. Although it's harder to do that with the opening portion, just because you're supposed to be moving pawns to doors that they can open. and there's not necessarily a color order that you can work in that way. You can do it for like the very opening, like just say, you know, let's do the yellow door, then the orange door, then the purple door, then the green door, and then we'll just move from there. And you can't really stick to that order after that, because you might not find any more orange doors in the next batch. You might just have to stick to certain colors. But certainly after you have, or when you're approaching the end game and you're about to steal everything and you flip the timer for the last time, that is exactly when you want to choose an order. And a tip for how to choose your order is you should always go, it doesn't really matter what the first three are, but the fourth one should always be one that has to pass by a hourglass space in case you need to flip the hourglass one last time.
Yeah.
So just plan for that one to be, or just however much time you have left, plan which pawn you're going to move to an hourglass if you need the time, and throw it in the order at the appropriate spot.
Yeah. As far as the way you explore the mall, if everybody's stores have been found, then you know that the exits have to be next. So like if the stores are kind of in a cluster and you already have some of the exits out but not the others, you can try to explore with certain exits closer to the stores. Does that make sense? Like if you know that the purple exit is the only exit left, then explore near the purple store,
right?
It's near there.
The way you could put that is that as you discover stores and exits, then you're going to start whittling down the remaining possible stores and exits left in the stack of tiles that you have to explore. And so when it gets to that point, you should be exploring near the stores that those exits are corresponding with.
Exactly.
So like you said, if you're down to like the orange store and the purple exit, then you should be exploring around the purple store and the orange exit so that they're very close together, so that you don't waste so much time moving the orange pawn from its store to its exit, and same thing for the purple pawn.
Yeah. Another thing is, I think generally during exploration, you don't want to be moving all four pawns. So usually you can have one pawn kind of stay near a timer, so that if you need to emergency flip the timer, you have that option.
Now, that's one way of putting it, but I would like to put it to everybody who plays this game to just always pay attention to the timer.
Yeah, definitely.
It's like a big problem. I mean, it's the only way you lose is if the timer runs out. And so everyone should pay very close attention to the timer. If you're playing the game and you think like, oh, it's been a while since I looked at the timer, I should look at the timer. Look at the timer, because when it comes to, you know, the final moments, and only one person is paying attention to the timer, one person is never enough to hit the timer on the board.
Exactly.
It takes everybody to do that. So everyone needs to pay attention to the timer at all times. Now, the benefit of paying very close attention to the timer is that you get more time if you wait till the very last moment to flip the timer. Because if you flip the timer with 30 seconds left, then that means you only have 2 minutes and 30 seconds on that timer until you have to flip it again. But if you wait till the last second, then you could have almost the full 3 minutes to work with.
Exactly, yeah. And making sure that you're keeping track of the timer lets you flip it closer to that, and keeping track of where the spaces are lets you micromanage that better. But also, the longer you wait's better, because you do have, like we said, a limited amount of timer flip spaces.
Yes.
So like each one has to count
three times. Exactly.
Right. So if you flip it three times after a minute and a half has passed, then what would that be? 6 minutes versus closer to 12 minutes if you wait longer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's a big difference if you wait longer. It adds up over time. A couple things. So when I play this game, a lot of people get lost. And there's times when where everyone could be looking at one person and expecting them to make a move, and they have no idea what to move. So ways that you could brag or grab their attention for that is at least to move the pawn that you intend for them to move. It's not illegal to move a pawn, even if you're moving it in a bad direction, just to point out, like, that's the pawn we're trying to move right now. Yeah. If they're confused. So that's at least one way to communicate a little something beyond, like, within the scope of the rules. But otherwise, if you don't know what to do, just pay attention to what other people are moving and then ask yourself if you could be moving that too.
Yeah.
Like, there's, it can help to kind of visualize what the goals are. So, like, look at a pawn and spot where the nearest door of a matching color is and try to move towards it. But if just you are paying attention to the goals that you have in mind, then things are going to get a little lost. So try to figure out what other people's goals are by looking at what they're moving and where they're moving it to.
Yeah. I don't have much else, honestly. Oh, there are rooms that can have multiple exits from them. And I think this is really good if you explore from a room that's, like, an important one, like a room with an item or with a shop in it, and the next room you flip over doesn't have anything important in it, then I would recommend going back and going to the other exit of the first room just to keep things close together instead of having, like, this long pathway.
Although it's likely that that exit uses a different colored pawn, so...
Yeah.
So what you mean is to say is to get the pawn for the other door and open that door before you keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Though
I guess... I don't know.
Go ahead.
I was going to say it's harder to move before you have all the shops revealed, because then you can easily have everybody focus on the same thing. So I don't know.
But what you're saying is just to, like, eliminate these hallways between two important locations.
Right.
Like... If you get a room that has nothing important in it, then that room can just be a dead end.
Exactly.
And you can just keep all the important stuff tightly knit.
Exactly.
I guess the last thing to say is if you get gaveled, look at every piece and see if you can move it, and just move the ones that you can move. The worst feeling in this game is when you... give someone the gavel and then they just don't do anything.
Yeah.
So if you get gaveled, look at all the pieces and see what you can move. Remember, pay close attention to what your ability is, because if you have the portal especially, they might just be saying, like, move something to a portal. And even if you don't know which portal to go to, just moving to any portal, you know, is better than nothing.
Right.
All right, So if that's all we have for strategy, let's talk design.
Yes. So this is an interesting game because it's very similar to one we covered earlier this year, The Mind. Mm-hmm. This is a cooperative game that is built around reduced communication. And this is something I think there's been more of recently. It does help with one of the big problems cooperative games can have that we mention a lot, which is quarterbacking, where one player kind of dominates the game, kind of plays everybody else's characters or does everybody else's actions because they've seen a path to victory, and winning in this case is more important to them than having everyone else do their own thing.
Yeah, and be engaged.
Right. But so, you know, limiting speech tends to help avoid that. Because even though you can still kind of micromanage when you're planning while the timer's flipped, you know, during the moment-to-moments, players are having to make their own decisions and pay very close attention to everything themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't really tell somebody to move a given piece that easily in this game. And so that does help avoid that and keep everybody engaged. And also the fact that every player has their own action they can do. I think even when you add more players, there's no overlap between players as far as what their cards let them do. I think it just splits up what the cards...
It adds arrows.
It does?
Game.
Okay, I thought it just split up them.
No, it adds arrows. So there will be two players with the same arrow.
Well, still.
For some of the different arrows. I don't think it adds special abilities, though.
Sure.
There's still only one of those per card. There's just extra arrows.
Well, still, like, each player has their own abilities they're able to do, and their own abilities are strictly not able to do. And there's a definite mindset you get into when you're moving a pawn in one direction. Like, you only see things going that direction. You don't even think about moving them in anything else. So it kind of forces players to view the board differently because they have their own sort of things they can do. Because when you have to rotate the directions, for me at least, it ends up feeling like, you know, you're kind of lost balance a bit after you've rotated your actions, because you kind of have to reorient how you're viewing the board. And I think that effect is intentional.
Yeah. I mean, they don't do that until your third session playing the game, which I think is a pretty good place to add that mechanic. First session, you keep the arrow you're given. Second session, you keep the arrow you're given. Third session, now you start shuffling things up. But you only do that three times during the game, or however many times it takes to flip the timer. And you also do get that brief moment after you flip the timer to talk, to also just like re-examine the board and remind yourself and commit to memory what your card says that you do. So they have ways of softening that shock.
Right. But then, the timer is the other thing that really helps aid that, to prevent quarterbacking and keep the engagement there, because, there's a lot of good things you can do with a sand timer or an hourglass timer. So, like, you can't tell exactly how much time you have, which means that, like, as the sand starts to dwindle, there's more pressure. Because think of, like, if you had 30 seconds left on a timer that's, like, a digital timer, it might be, you know, fairly stressful, maybe. But with a sand timer, that's, like, just a little bit of sand at the very top. It's a lot harder to tell that you even have 30 seconds versus 20 or 25 or 15. So it adds that tension as the time progresses, but before you actually lose. So there's still like the jolting moment where it gets really quick, crazy, but that's obviously, you have plenty of time to react to it.
I also want to call attention, since we're on the sand timer, to the fact that it's a sand timer that gets used both ways, which is a unique mechanic that I haven't seen in many other games.
Yeah.
You know, adds that extra gameplay decision of when you flip the timer, because if you flip it soon, then you're going to have less time in the bank.
Right.
That's a pretty unique mechanic and a pretty interesting thing to have in a game. Right. I just think that's like a pretty ingenious use of component there.
I think it's neat because it also, it's optimal to flip the timer very late, which means that it's optimal to go into these fast pressure situations where, like, you know, you really need somebody to flip a timer in a specific area, and you're trying to get them to realize that. It's sort of that tendency players have to do the most optimal thing just because it's the most optimal. In this case, though, instead of it being like something that hurts you, it's something that creates these climaxes. You know, because it's good to wait till as long as possible, players will wait as long as possible. And because they do so, they're going to run into these really tense situations multiple times throughout the game.
I also want to say, like, it's a 3-minute timer. And that just seems to be, like, the perfect amount of time for a lot of things in this game. Like, a 3-minute timer is just barely too little time to find all of the tiles that you need to find with, like, a relatively coordinated team. Like, you probably won't be able to find every tile within that 3 minutes, but you'll find a good amount of tiles at every stage in the game. So, like, and having the stages coordinate with your familiarity with the game. It's also, like, it's also a good time just that, like, if you do run out of time for after you've spent 3 minutes, 6 minutes, whatever, if the timer runs out and you lose, that's not a ton of time that you just wasted playing a game and lost. So it's not like you wasted your time. And it's also not like if you have to start again, it's not going to take that much time to get back to where you were.
Yeah. I do like another thing about The way it's paced using the timer is that because the uses of the timer flip spaces are limited, it feels more risky to use them just because you only have so many. And, like, you have the knowledge that you only have so many. Mm-hmm. Which means that, like, for one thing, it does add to that pressure to wait longer before you flip it over. But it also encourages players to think more on the fly and not plan as much, because they don't have as many chances to plan. So, like, early game, you really want to push as far as you can before having to flip it again. So, like, it encourages players to act individually a bit more. Mm-hmm. And at that same point, because you can't talk once you're done moving, but time still progresses while you're planning, it kind of pressures players into making quick plans instead of really charting things out or really plotting things out.
Right. You know, like when you get to the end of the game, like the only thing you can really do is just say the colors, like in the order that you intend to do them, and then just get to it and hope everyone remembers.
Because there's
luckily there's one that I've always wanted to try just to shorthand it, and that's just the colors are there's a tile that set aside the board that shows like which item each color pawn is looking for, and then when you flip it over, it shows which exit they're looking for, and it also has a little symbol that says no portals. But they're in an order on that tile, and you could always use that order if you want. That would just help people remember.
Yeah. Let's see. The gavel is pretty fun, in my opinion.
I want to say the gavel is very good to include in this game because it's a lot to ask a group of players to not talk or communicate at all. And so throwing them that bone of saying like, fine, if you absolutely must communicate, use this gavel in the way that we tell you. It kind of like it's kind of like you give them just a little bit of allowance and that keeps them happy. That keeps the players happy.
Yeah,
that so they won't like go around and cheat or try and like if you say like don't talk or communicate, then people are going to like, you know, come up with excuses for like how they want to talk or communicate.
Yeah,
in like various ways. It's kind of like when we played the mind, people that were playing would say like, here's how we do it. We wait this many seconds, and that tells you that many numbers have passed. But like that's not the point. You can't do that. You can't plan outside of the game. And so in this game, it kind of keeps you from having those kinds of conversations by saying, if you want to communicate, then communicate like this. And I'll chalk up all the ways that we did that wrong to just not reading the rules closely enough. Because if you read them close enough, then it says exactly how to use the gavel. And that's the only way that you can communicate anything in this game.
Yeah. But there's also that, like, the gavel is big and kind of loud. So if somebody just places it in front of you and you have no idea why, it can be really surprising and kind of distracting. You know, it can startle you. But since only one player can hold the gavel, if someone is convinced that something needs to be done, but like nobody else is convinced about it or notices it, it can be kind of locked down and unable to be used. And you can't ask somebody, can I see the gavel or can I have the gavel, because you can't talk. But what I think is interesting about that is that means that, like, one player can monopolize the gavel, but they can't actually use it to monopolize the game through that, you know. Since like... I guess it's sort of weird because, like, on one hand, somebody can just monopolize the only form of communication. On the other hand, if they're really moving it around a lot or holding close onto it, then they're not focusing on the tile itself. So, like, it's detrimental for them. But then also, like, if somebody tries to do that, then they might not be able to get as much information across as they hope, and it would be kind of pointless. It's weird. Like, the gavel is only marginally useful, it feels like.
Well, I will say that technically the way that it's supposed to be used is you set it in front of somebody.
Right.
So you don't like bang it like a real gavel.
Yeah.
And after you use it, you're not supposed to hold on to it. You're supposed to place it and let go of it.
That's
so true. So, I mean, you could place it, let go of it, and then immediately snatch it up. But that kind of defeats the purpose of like how you're supposed to be communicating with people.
Yeah.
You're supposed to say like, you have to do something, and it doesn't make sense to take it away from them before they've done what they're supposed to do. Right. So it's not exactly like the way that the gavel is supposed to be used. It's not easy to hoard it to yourself.
Right. I guess on one hand, that means that like plenty of other players, if playing the intended way, have chances to move it along, which means one person is less likely to make all of the gavel placement commands. But it does have like this weird effect where like it doesn't always really convey anything, because whoever is being told to do something with the gavel still has to figure out what they have to do and where they have to do it. And I think it's weird because like it kind of means the gavel doesn't have as much of a use, almost like a placebo in a way, in that like it doesn't really do anything. Because it's implied in the game that by playing the game, you kind of understand that you always have to do something. You know, like by participating in the game, it's not like you're just waiting for your turn.
I'm not sure I follow that.
Okay, I guess a way to put it would be like the gavel's purpose is to tell somebody to do something. Yeah. But they you can't tell them what, so they still have to figure out what to do. But ideally, when you're playing this game, you should already be thinking, what should I do? Is there anything I need to do at the moment? So, like, what I'm saying is the role that the gavel fills is just reminding people to follow the mindset they should be using while playing the game.
I that's one way of looking at it. I think that just there's four things to keep track of in this game, and the gavel is really just supposed to tell somebody like you're not keeping track of the thing that I need you to keep track of at the moment. So it's like you're probably focused on a different pawn than the one that I'm trying to move. So my gavel is telling you like you need to focus on this pawn, unless you have a special ability, like especially the portal. The gavel is a little confusing when it comes to the portal player. I think maybe that might just have to be a rule that like, the problems that arise from the gavel just comes from like players not paying attention.
Yeah. But that's what I mean.
And not paying attention to everything, which is nobody can pay attention to everything. So the gavel is just supposed to like refocus you. Like,
I guess.
Try paying attention to something else. Yeah. And in that case, the gavel succeeds a little bit, especially with that very first point you make, that it kind of like snaps you out of a trance.
Yeah.
It kind of grabs your attention. And that can be very helpful in this game if you're fixating too much on something.
Yeah, that's fair. Because if somebody places it in front of you, you kind of take your eyes away from the board for a second. So if you were like really honing in on one corner of the board, it helps draw you away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And move you back into the sort of overall bird's eye view.
Mm-hmm. Visually, things are pretty solid in this game.
Mm-hmm.
Components wise, the hourglass, I've talked about how much I love that component. The other components are a little light and slidey. So it's a little unfortunate that you could like bump the tiles of the map and they could shift pretty dramatically, or you could pick up a pawn and set it down and it could just like topple over, like especially during like tense situations or fast paced situations, you could pick up a pawn, set it down, it'll topple over and roll to like a different part of the board.
It's also
unfortunate.
It's also weird that the entrances to rooms aren't in the center of the tiles edges. They're all at like slightly skewed to one side. So when you line up all the tiles in the maze, there's like these small square gaps between them in each corner.
Well, that's just so that the tiles could be rotationally symmetrical but have an even number of grid spaces on them.
Right. I just mean that does contribute to them sliding around a bit.
Sure.
Is that they're not quite airtight together.
Yeah, it's harder to push them back in the right spot too because of that.
Yeah.
But still, like, the pawns are also just kind of slippery, and it can be a little rough keeping track of exactly where they're supposed to be on a tile. Like, you could, like, skip over a wall on accident if a pawn just kind of falls over and rolls a little bit, or just slides a little bit.
Yeah.
If things get bumped. So it's a little unfortunate there, but it's a pretty small package for a game, so you can't really expect more for that. Other than that, I think that's about it for all I have to say on Magic Maze.
I think that's about it, yeah.
It's a very solid game with unconventional communication, much like The Mind. So if you like The Mind, check out Magic Maze. That's something we haven't been doing lately.
And vice versa.
Giving those recommendations. Yeah, if you like The Mind, check out Magic Maze. Magic Maze, check out The Mind.
Yeah.
And with that, that will conclude our episode on Magic Maze. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you like to, you can follow us on any podcasting platform, leave a review. You can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast. Hit us up with suggestions for games and topics that you like us to cover there. Or just share your general appreciation of the podcast with us, or critiques. We're happy to hear those too. If you want to look for more episodes, you can also go to our website at bgbcast.com, where we have everything tagged and organized. So if you're looking for our thoughts on a specific game, you can find a tag for that game on our website, and that'll take you directly to the episode. If you don't see the game you're looking for, that means we haven't covered it. Again, hit us up with the suggestions on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. Also on our website, you can find a link to our T Public store. It's tpublic.com/user/BGBcast. BGBcast. And that's where we have merch with our cool logo on it. You can get a t-shirt, rep the podcast at your next board game night or board game convention. We'd really appreciate that. And that does it for Board Game Bros plug, so let's hear it from Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak. I stream on most weekdays from about 12 p.m. Central Time to 2 or 3 p.m. Central Time. I speedrun, I play a lot of roguelites, platformers, exploration games, you name it games. And through that Twitch stream, you can also find in that page a link to a Discord server where you can talk to other fans of our work, as well as get updates on when I go live. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming to see when I go live. And you can also see updates on my articles, which I write on the Board Game Bros website under the Episodes and Articles tab. My most recent article was about the game Untitled Goose Game. I write a lot about game design, writing, stuff like that. So if you're interested in more analytical stuff, check those out.
All right, that does it for Matt Plugs, and that does it for our episode. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
See ya.